Tonight, Michael Brown joins me here.
He's the former FEMA director.
Talk show host Michael Brown.
Brownie!
No.
Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
The Situation with Michael Brown.
You're a political expert.
On KOA News Radio.
There's a cover-up going on, and I'm not talking about fraud accusations in the election or anything like that. I forgot to do this story, and it's been sitting on my desk, and I finally decided I need to get this off my chest. A little before Thanksgiving, actually a day before Thanksgiving, the Johns Hopkins University newsletter, it's published by the students of Johns Hopkins, and it's been published continuously since 1896, posted a story titled A Closer Look at U.S. Deaths Due to COVID-19. Now, if you had a chance, and I'm sorry if you did, to watch the opening of any of the three network news stories tonight, it was fear, fear, fear. Spikes in deaths, and we're just all going to die. We might as well just all go drink the Kool-Aid, Jim Jones style, and just get it over with. But a professor by the name of Genevieve Briand, B-R-I-A-N-D, wrote this story. She wanted to look at COVID deaths and see if the data that we're getting is really giving us the right perspective on those deaths or not. So let me read just a few paragraphs of it to give you a flavor. According to new data, the U.S. currently ranks first in total COVID-19 cases, new cases per day, and deaths. Genevieve Brand, Assistant Program Director of the Applied Economics Master's Degree Program at Johns Hopkins, critically analyzed the effect of COVID-19 on U.S. deaths using data from the CDC in a webinar titled COVID-19 Deaths, A Look at U.S. Data. From mid-March to mid-September, total deaths in this country reached 1.7 million, of which, according to the CDC, 200,000, now remember this is, she did this story back at probably second week of November, published just before Thanksgiving. U.S. total deaths have reached 1.7 million, of which 200,000, or 12% of total deaths, all deaths in the U.S., 12% are COVID-19 related. But instead of looking directly at COVID-19 deaths, the professor focused on total deaths per age group and per cause of death in the United States and used that information to shed light on the effects of COVID-19. She explained that the significance of COVID-19 on U.S. deaths can be fully understood only through comparison to the total number of total deaths in the United States. In other words, every year the CDC tracks how many people die every single week. And so we have an average, a running average, of the number of people that die every single week in this country. So you would think that, and I'm getting off from the story for just a moment. I want to give you some context. You would think then that if the excess deaths are 1,000, and that U.S. total deaths, according to her story, was 200,000 or 12% of total deaths, that there would be, if there were 1,000 deaths, 12%, 120 excess deaths, right? She explained that the significance of COVID-19 on U.S. deaths can only be understood through the comparison to the number of total deaths in the United States. So after receiving data on the CDC website, she compiled a graph representing percentages of total deaths per age category from early February to early September, which includes the period from before COVID-19 was detected in the United States to after infection rates soared. Surprisingly, the deaths of older people stayed the same before and after COVID-19. She writes, since COVID-19 mainly affects the elderly, experts expected an increase in the percentage of deaths in older age groups. However, this increase is not seen from the CDC data. In fact, the percentages of deaths among all age groups remains relatively the same. She says, quote, the reason we have a higher number of reported COVID-19 deaths among older individuals than younger individuals is simply because every day in the United States, older individuals die in higher numbers than younger individuals. You know, it doesn't take a master's degree or a PhD in logic to understand that. As we're told, the American population continues to age, and baby boomers continue to get older and older and older. More start to die off, and you would expect higher death rates. And that's exactly what she found. But she also noted that 50 to 70,000 deaths are seen both before and after COVID-19, indicating that that number of deaths was normal long before COVID-19 emerged. Therefore, according to Briand, not only has COVID-19 had no effect on the percentage of deaths of older people, but has also not increased the total number of deaths. Now, let's go back to my point earlier about the CDC tracking all deaths in the United States constantly. That's why we have death certificates. And those death certificates, whether you die of natural causes or you die and there's a medical examiner that has to examine you because of an auto wreck or something, those deaths get reported to the state health departments that then report them to the CDC. And that's where we get the average number of deaths in any given week or month, whatever period you want to look at, in the United States. So you would make an assumption, right, that with the advent of COVID-19, there would be, just imagine a graph. And the graph across the bottom is just the number, average number of deaths. And let's just say that's gray. Well, with the advent of COVID-19, you would think that there would be, because of the 200,000 or 12% additional deaths, that there would be a 12% additional deaths on top of that gray graph. Let's just say it's yellow. So you have a relatively stable, and it kind of fluctuates. It's like a wave. It just is constantly going up and down, pretty much the same across any 12-month period. So you would assume that when COVID-19 hit, that gray graph, that waves like an ocean wave, that there would be on top of that the yellow excess deaths caused by COVID-19. Yet she found that wasn't the case. And she says, this comes as a shock to many people. How is it that the data lie so far from our perception? And then she went on to explain why. She says there's a sudden increase in deaths in 2020 due to COVID-19. That's no surprise. Analysis of deaths per cause in 2018 revealed that the pattern of seasonal increase in the total number of deaths is a result of the rise in deaths by all causes. In other words, in 2018, we saw an increase in the total number of deaths. So that when COVID-19 hit, as that increased number of deaths continued to occur because more people got older and died more often, the excess deaths weren't that bad. So what's the cover-up? Stay tuned. I'll tell you what happened to this article when we get back. You're listening to The Situation with Michael Brown on KOA News Radio. Let's see if Darren Copeland's covering up anything about the traffic. So this article, welcome back to The Situation with Michael Brown on KOA News Radio. This article was originally written on November 22nd, published on November 26th. A closer look at U.S. deaths due to COVID-19. And as Professor Brand looked through all of the data, she found a pattern that shows that, well, actually the number of deaths isn't quite as bad as we think it is, particularly when you compare it to the number of excess deaths. Because, look, a certain number of people are going to die every year. People are going to, they're going to have car wrecks, they're going to have cancer, they're going to have any number of things, and they're going to get old. And then the older they get, the more likely they are to die. I mean, if you took the subset of people that are, say, 95 years of age or older, the likelihood of that subset, a greater percentage of that subset dying in any given year is greater, obviously, than a subset of, say, 0 to 15-year-olds. And she found, well, wait a minute. When you look at this, there's an over-exaggeration of COVID death number that is probably due to the constant emphasis on COVID-19-related deaths and the habitual overlooking of deaths by other natural causes in society. It's a fascinating story. You can't find it anymore. Johns Hopkins published the article and then deleted it. Now, why would you delete an article? Now, if there were horrific mistakes in her methodology, if there was out-and-out fraud, if it was so intellectually devoid of any factual data, yeah, you would do that. You would delete the article. And if it was any of those things, you would publish a retraction. Hey, we published the story. We didn't get it peer-reviewed. We didn't have the editors look at it. We found horrific mistakes in it. And we decided, we're going to pull the article. Well, that's not the case. According to the professor, who compared the total deaths per age category from both before and after the onset of the pandemic, the death rate of older people stayed the same before and after coronavirus. That's the takeaway. And she said that the reason we have a higher number of reported COVID-19 deaths among older individuals than younger individuals is simply because every day in the United States, older individuals die in higher numbers than younger individuals. The results contradict the way most people see the impact of the coronavirus pandemic, which disproportionately affects the elderly population. Professor Brand believes, after reviewing the numbers, that coronavirus deaths are being over-exaggerated. After seeing that in 2020, coronavirus-related deaths exceeded deaths from heart disease. Let me repeat that. After seeing that in 2020, coronavirus-related deaths exceeded deaths from heart disease, which is the leading cause of death in the United States for many years prior, Professor Brand began to suspect that the coronavirus death toll figure was misleading. And indeed, she did find that the total decrease in deaths by other causes almost exactly equals the increase in deaths by COVID-19. She found that the total decrease in deaths, remember that gray scale, little wavy gray scale, just the average annual number of deaths? She found that the total decrease in deaths by other causes almost exactly equaled the increase in deaths by COVID-19. Well, hell's bells. Does that mean that COVID-19 actually causes fewer people to die of heart disease or cancer or any other comorbidity? I don't think so. But don't you find it fascinating that her study finds that the total decrease in deaths by other causes almost exactly equals the increase in deaths by COVID-19? She said, if the COVID-19 death toll was not misleading at all, what we should have observed is an increased number of heart attacks and increased COVID-19 numbers, but a decreased number of heart attacks and all the other death causes doesn't give us a choice but to point to some misclassification. If the COVID-19 death toll was not misleading at all, she says, what we should have observed is an increased number of heart attacks and increased COVID-19 numbers. But instead, she says, we have a decreased number of heart attacks and all the other death causes, and it doesn't give us a choice but to point to misclassification of deaths. All of this points to no evidence that COVID-19 created any excess deaths. Total death numbers are not above normal death numbers. She says, we found no evidence to the contrary. You know, if you have succumbed to the COVID-19 fear porn that is just blasted into your eyeballs and your ears every single day, you might find this incredibly difficult to believe. I've dug through the article. I've looked at her charts. I've looked at the CDC website. And I find nothing. I can't find any holes in her methodology or in her study. But here's what I want you to know. Several days after removing the article from the Johns Hopkins newsletter website, Johns Hopkins University tweeted that the article, A Closer Look at U.S. Deaths to COVID-19, was deleted because the article was being used to support false and dangerous inaccuracies about the impact of the pandemic. We regret that this article may have contributed to the spread of misinformation about COVID-19. Now, nowhere do you find any explanation of that. Nowhere do you find anywhere a description of how it was deleted because it supported false and dangerous inaccuracies. No, it went against the narrative. And Johns Hopkins, which produces that scary red death map, well, they couldn't have somebody on their campus, let alone a statistician and a professor of economics and who understands all of this stuff. They couldn't have somebody like that actually looking at the numbers and going against their own narrative. So what do we do? What does Johns Hopkins do? We delete the article and say we regret that the article may have contributed to the spread of misinformation without ever telling us, hey, what is that misinformation? What are the inaccuracies? Because inquiring minds, critical thinkers, people studying this really would like to know. But we never will. The COVID vaccine coming up next. You're listening to The Situation with Michael Brown on KOA News Radio. Let's take a quick break, and I'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to The Situation with Michael Brown on KOA News Radio. So at the bottom of the hour, I was listening to Kathy give the news, and she was talking about Gavin Newsom and his shutting down of California. Mayor Garcetti of Los Angeles did the same thing today. And their justification for doing so is they're worried again, as we keep being told, that they're worried about the healthcare system being overrun. Well, I think that plays on most Americans' ignorance of the economics of hospitals and how hospitals operate. Because you hear that if ICU capacity gets used up beyond 80%, then, oh my gosh, that means we gotta shut everything down and keep people out of the hospitals. That's not how hospitals work. Methodist Hospital CEO Dr. Mark Boom says this: it is completely normal for us to have ICU capacities that run in the 80 and 90%. That's how all hospitals operate. He goes on to point out that occupancy was highest in surgical ICUs at 79%, ICUs in federal hospitals at 80%, in ICUs of hospitals with between 300 and 750 beds, averaging at 77%. So there's excess capacity built in. The hospitals know that they want to run their ICU beds somewhere between 80 and 90% in order to make sure that they're turning a profit. That's how they make their money. And you also make your money by moving people in and out of those ICU beds as quickly as possible. If you've got somebody in an ICU bed and they're you know, they can be moved into a regular room or a, I forget what the phrase is, but there's a phrase for a above a standard room. It's kind of like looking at a hotel, right? Do I get the standard suite or do I get the luxury suite? Well, there's the standard room, there's an ICU bed, and there's a different level of care in between, and I can't think of the name of it. Hospitals make money by having patients fill their beds. How do you think airlines make money? By filling seats. How do you think hotels make money? By filling rooms. How do apartment complexes make money? By filling them up. But we've come to believe that if we get above 80 or 90% in ICU capacity in a hospital, that, oh my gosh, people are going to be dying on the streets. That's certainly not the case in Colorado. In Colorado, we still pay, I forget how much it is per million per month, that we pay to the city and county of Denver for the Colorado Convention Center. And then whatever the facility is up in Loveland. Where we have excess bed capacity. If Colorado has excess bed capacity by building out the convention center and a place up in Loveland, I got to believe that California, as stupid as I think California is, that California has to have some excess capacity over here in the drawer somewhere. They just don't want to talk about it. Because you can't put the fear of COVID in people if you try to explain to them, well, you know, hospitals usually operate between 80 and 90% capacity. And if they exceed that, we have, we've asked the Army Corps of Engineer to build a hospital over here. And don't forget, we still have the USS Comfort and the USS Hope that we can send to either coast to help fill hospital beds. Didn't that seem like a century ago that we did that in New York Harbor? We send the USNS Comfort up the Hudson River so that Andrew Cuomo can take all of the people that are just, you know, remember we had pictures of reefer trucks and not enough space in the morgue, so people are being, bodies, cadavers are being put in trucks, and the hospitals were being overrun. So the government sends the Comfort, a magnificent hospital ship, sends it up the Hudson, and it never gets used. Never gets used. So when you hear these stories about California shutting down, and they're doing so because they're afraid that, you know, they might exceed their hospital bed capacity, just ask yourself, one, is that true? And if they operate normally at 80 or 90%, what contingency plans have they made if they exceed that? If they get to 101%? If they get to 100.5%? Because if they haven't made contingency plans for that, they're committing COVID and political malpractice. Now let's talk about the vaccine. That was also in the news. I had to chuckle about that. So I think it was Pfizer. I think Kathy said it was Pfizer that, yeah, well, instead of 100 million doses, yeah, we're down to 50 million doses. Because we found some crap in the vaccine that's not supposed to be there. Now, is anybody shocked by this? When you start ramping up manufacturing and you have whatever QC and QA that you can put in place, at some point, no matter how much QC, quality control, or QA, quality assurance that you have, if the speed overruns the QC and the QA, you're naturally going to have screw-ups. And Pfizer's got screw-ups. Which then leads me to think about, because this is all in the news today too. Apparently, former presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama have agreed that when the vaccine becomes available, that they're going to take that vaccine on TV. You wouldn't know what I really think. Those syringes will be full of saline. You know why? Because, and I can't speak for Clinton or Obama, But I can speak, not for Bush, but I can speak about Bush. And I can speak about his physicians and the doctors that he keeps around him. They're not going to let him take a chance with it. There's no way. There's no way they're going to do a high-profile injection of a vaccine that, oh, by the way, we've had to pull 50% of it off the shelves because, well, we got some stuff in it that shouldn't be there. Yeah, you're gonna inject that into George W.? I don't think so. So you can call me a nut job, but I don't think they're really going to get the vaccine. No, they're going to wait until other people get it. They'll take a saline shot. They'll see how everybody else is doing. And then once everybody else survives, once everybody else sees what the side effects are, because the last thing you want to do is give it to a Clinton, Obama, or Bush, and then have them end up in the ICU because of the side effects. It's a high-profile publicity stunt made for TV in Washington, D.C. You're listening to The Situation with Michael Brown on KOA News Radio. Let's see what Darren Copeland's doing at the traffic or if he'll take the vaccine, and I'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to The Situation with Michael Brown on KOA News Radio. So let's continue talking about the vaccines for a second. I actually think the vaccination deployment is unnecessary. It's just part of this ongoing blatant in-your-face power and money grab by governments, emboldened by public health experts, and honestly, wildly irresponsible big pharma giants. You know, and I always feel like I have to give this caveat. I'm not anti-big pharma. I love the medications I take. Over the years, medications have done wonders for me. Probably you too. But I think it's time to stop litigating the past and look on the bright side of things. Let's just forget about all of this since back in March, 9 months ago. Hell's bells, we've had a baby since then. Proponents of human freedom have been presented with a golden opportunity to use this coming vaccine rollout as an instrument for a return to normalcy. Now, notice I didn't say the new normal, because I'm opposed to the new normal. I want to go back to the old normal. President Trump announced during that Thanksgiving address that the vaccine might begin to make its way to Americans as soon as next week. I think maybe by... maybe by December 15th, a couple of weeks away. And the FDA is considering authorization for a bunch of COVID-19 vaccines over the next days and weeks. So we're going to have a plethora of vaccines. Well, big pharma brands have already cashed the multi-billion dollar checks from world governments, and hundreds of millions of vaccine doses are being produced for a disease that has a 99% recovery rate. So the debate over whether the coronavirus vaccine is a necessary thing for all of society, it's over. That battle was fought a long time ago, and the vaccine for all crowd has won the day. So we ought to focus on the days ahead. And I would just say, in case I run out of time, I want to make sure I get this point in. I would say that you ought to get ready to, whether you go to work, whether you travel, whether you go to a restaurant, hell's bells, whether you go to the local mall, to be greeted by a mall cop or somebody that says, "May we see your papers, please? May we see your papers, please?" According to the World Economic Forum, those goober globalists, these are the countries that have pre-ordered the most COVID vaccines. Canada, 127% of what they need. Japan, 114%. The United Kingdom, 108%. The United States, 106%. Australia and the EU, they drop down into the 80s and 70%. So for those of us who are seeking an end to this kind of semi-permanent state of corona madness, I think we can leverage the vaccine to lobby for a return to normalcy. The vaccine has become akin to an emotional recovery animal. So if you're fearful and terrorized, if you're eating up every bit of propaganda that's being served up to you by all these experts, this ought to make you smile. This is like rainbows and lollipops. It's over, right? Well, I would think so. All of these people that I talk about, these wizards are smart. They've created a world for themselves where every human being is an immediate threat to their own life, and the only thing that's going to help them escape their self-created nightmare is a vaccine. And due to the constant state of fear and terror, they are completely inaccessible. They've checked out from searching for facts, and they're not going to come back to the sanity table until they've gotten their vaccine. And I do believe that there are millions of people who have passed the point of no return to sanity, unless they are assisted by their promised cure. I spoke to a doctor. I'm not going to say when, or because if you listen to the afternoon program, you might be able to figure this out. I spoke to a doctor about the vaccine. You taking it, doc? No, I'm going to wait a while. And your reasoning? Well, I want to see what the efficacy is, and I want to see what the side effects are. And I'm healthy and in good shape. I think I've been exposed. I've got a few antibodies. I'm just not going to take that risk right now. It's a doctor. I'm just a stupid lawyer. But I think there are millions of people who have passed the point of no return to sanity unless they get the vaccine. But I think, you know, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. I think for that reason alone, I think the COVID-19 vaccine will be an incredibly useful tool for return to normalcy. It'll help herd the terrorized, unresponsive sheep right back into some form of normalcy. It'll help them get back to some state of functionality. I'm not worried about the informed and thoughtful readers, people that listen to this program and critically think about what I offer. But I do recognize the reality that that you and I are probably in a very small minority when it comes to our outlook on the pandemic. There are hundreds of millions of people around the world that don't share the perspective that I do. They've been completely propagandized in submission. They've lived every day of their lives this year worried about a very mildly threatening respiratory virus. I've known 3 or 4 people that have gotten it, including members of my own family. All mild cases. I've known some people that I think have had it that were asymptomatic. And I know, don't get me wrong, I understand that for every example I give, somebody else can find some horrific example because they'll plaster it all over the evening news about some poor soul who succumbed to it for no reason or because they had some horrible comorbidity. You know, that's kind of the nature of being human beings. In these carbon bodies, what affects one person may not affect another person. What causes one person to die leaves another asymptomatic. The flu. You know, I mentioned earlier in the afternoon show, when you think about the bombing of London, Londoners didn't shut down. Businesses stayed open. And the air raid sirens would go off, and they would go down into the tube if they were working anywhere in the city center of London. Or if they lived in the burbs, they would go to the lowest floor of their flat. Or you think about the Warsaw Ghetto during the Holocaust. The Jews and the Poles and the others that were stuck in the ghetto continued to teach their children. Winston Churchill insisted that schools stay open in London and that businesses stay open, and they did. Shame on us. Shame on us. You think about what they went through in World War II. the way we're reacting now. Yeah, if the vaccine placates people, so be it. Let's just get back to normal. Everybody have a good night, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.